Good morning. Will there be help to assist foreign fishermen working on Hawaii's longline fleet? Advocates say a state agency has a legal obligation. Larry Geller details why the first step still rests with the DLNR. And Neil Conan is back on the farm. He'll join us later this hour. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderkirk. Singer-songwriter Martha Redbone explores the history of her own family in a new work of musical theater. She's in our studio to tell us about Bone Hill, the concert. And the Maui Farm reaches out to Hawaii families to share the rewards of life on the land.
For Tuesday, October 25th, that's The Conversation. Stay here. It all starts right after this news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vanderkirk. Good morning, Beth.
Good morning.
We're seeing a lot of attention paid in an area where there was hitherto very little attention paid, right?
It depends on how you define attention. And that's what we're going to talk about first this morning. Now, you know that this story of foreign fishermen confined to the boats which employ them while the boats are in port got a lot of press in the last 6 weeks. It seems, though, there are a few plans for a solution. Government agencies in Hawaii, including the Department of Land and Natural Resources, which licenses the fishermen, were called together for a briefing for lawmakers last week. Advocates for the fishermen had also circulated a petition asking DLNR to make its rules for the hiring process understandable to the applicants, the fishermen. The petition was denied also last week. Meanwhile, advocates, including Larry Geller of the online site Disappeared News, say they will continue to press for change. Larry Geller is in our studio this morning. Thank you for coming in.
Good morning, Beth Ann. Thank you for having me.
This issue, for a lot of people, is met with a great deal of shock and surprise and indignation at all of this. But when you get kind of past that and look at what you and other advocates say is really there, you're talking about illegalities. Now, the DLNR says, hey, look, labor issues are not our problem. That's not what we do. But your point seems to be that this is really a conservation issue.
It is. There was nothing in the petition that we filed with the Board of Land and Natural Resources that pertained to labor. The DLNR, Department of Land and Natural Resources, licenses the fishermen. And to break it down, there's been talk about a federal loophole and other complications that people find hard to understand. But let's focus down. Let's put the microscope on DLNR, because I believe, and I think others, all the other advocates also would say, that the fix on behalf of these fishermen to relieve them from the conditions that were reported by the AP, the fix has to start with DLNR. And the reason is, let me go right to one state law, HRS 189.5. It's very short. Aliens not admitted to the United States. It is unlawful for any person who has not been lawfully admitted to the United States to engage in taking marine life for commercial purposes in the waters of the state. That's not a labor law. That's intended to preserve our precious fishing resources.
Because presumably if someone doesn't really – if they haven't been admitted legally and they don't have a sense of what is legal or what is not legal – within the state or within the nation, that they wouldn't necessarily be able to comply with that if they don't understand it.
Precisely. That's exactly it. And there are other aspects of both state and federal law that DLNR needs to comply with that they're not now. One is Title VI of the Civil Rights Act and Executive Order 13166 to provide language services for limited English proficiency individuals. They're licensing people who probably cannot read anything on the page. Some may have English proficiency. Some may have it explained to them. We can't assume that. More likely, given the population, the state needs to provide translation or translations of the licenses, for example, or translator services in Tagalog, Bahasa Indonesia, Gilbertese, and possibly even Vietnamese, judging from the population of the fishing fleet today. And they're not. So what we have is I was able to obtain some fishing licenses, which are all basically typed up by either the ship owner or the captain or somebody. They're all identical. And the parts that would be filled out by hand in other licenses are not even filled out on this license. They're blank. So we don't really know, but it's very likely that these were just put in front of somebody and say and told, sign here, you know. They can't read it. So there's a clear violation of state law, and DLNR, the responsibility falls on DLNR to fix this. Now, there are other changes that will need to be made, probably on a state and federal level. But if we're going to get any relief for these fishermen so that to prevent abuses in the future, then we're going to have to begin to conform to our own state laws and to the federal law.
You bring up a point when you say if we're going to be able to do this for the future. I mean, very clearly and implicit in what you've said, at this point, there's no going back, and there may not be redress for the fishermen who have already been subject to the abuse they allege has happened. And that means that this is going to have to be a very separate issue as you look forward and looking at the DLNR to make changes so that this would be understandable to someone coming into a fishing fleet to be able to be employed. And also that state laws being complied with by those who are employing those fishermen.
Right. First thing, I think, and it's a simple, relatively simple thing given the complication of this whole issue, is let's conform to state law. That should go a long way to prevent abuse in the future. And yes, I think the fishermen who have been abused, how they get redress, I don't know.
But going forward, given the fact that DLNR has pretty much, put up its hands and says, no, we're not going to deal with this, what happens next? Obviously, you and the other advocates are not going to stop because you believe in this cause and the fact that something is clearly wrong. We're not conforming to law, as you say. What happens to force DLNR? Does this mean that this has to be pushed through the courts?
Well, DLNR will have to make these changes. So the question is, are they going to sit down and say, well, we're going to conform to the law? Or as happens in our government, that something will have to be done to make them conform to the law. I'm not going to say now what that is. I don't think I know what's best to do. My preference would be that DLNR conforms to the state law, just says, okay, we're going to do this. This story has gone around the world in various languages and newspapers and TV all across the globe. To think that Hawaii can continue the way they, the DLNR can continue the way they are, issuing licenses to people who can't read them, who are not supposed to be licensed in the first place, is absurd. It can't continue.
And that's a very separate issue from saying that the long-line fishing fleet is going to police itself and going to make sure that things are complied with the way they should be. That you just, that's almost at a point irrelevant compared to not complying legally as DLNR says, of course, as you say, DLNR is supposed to be doing.
Right. The so-called universal contract that the industry has put out, first of all, it's not enforceable. This was made clear towards the end of the last Wednesday's legislative briefing. But most of the newspaper reporters and almost all the cameras had already left the room. It had been more than 2 hours and 20 minutes of testimony at that point. But the contract isn't enforceable. And that's not going to do it by itself. So there are probably many other things that need to be done. It's not going to be a simple fix, but we need to do it for the sake of humanity, for morality and ethics. We just can't have this situation continue, and it won't be good for Hawaii. Whole Foods and a Seattle fishing company have already, not fishing company, a fish seller have already said they're not selling Hawaii fish. If this goes on, you can expect more retailers to join that bandwagon and say, until you get the human slavery out of your fishing fleet, we're not going to carry your fish. So the pressure must be on eventually. It's not going to continue.
Larry Geller, thank you for coming in. We'll be talking to you in the future. Thank you. Larry Geller is a board member of the Kukua Council for the Elderly. Also, he is the editor of the online blog Disappeared News and an advocate for foreign fishermen. You're listening to The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's now 8:15. Coming up, the story of a Cherokee family in Appalachia, told through music. First, though, your backyard quiz.
You might not consider skin ink as art, but in today's backyard quiz, we're thinking about a tattoo artist who became a Hawaii legend. We're looking for the name he's known by, not the one he was born with. That was Norman Keith Collins, born in Reno, Nevada in 1911. His early years were filled with travel and adventure, hopping freight trains across the country, learning the art of tattooing along the way. At first, he used the painstaking and painful hand-pricking method, later learning to use a machine from a man in Chicago named Tats Thomas. He enlisted in the Navy at 19 and was captivated by the tattoo art he saw as he traveled in Southeast Asia. When he settled in Honolulu's Chinatown, his artwork quickly became popular with sailors passing through the busy port, and he himself never gave up the sailing life, working as the skipper of a three-masted schooner that toured the island chain. His nickname has become a legendary one in the world of tattoo artists, and that's what we're looking for this morning. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer.
Support for The Conversation comes from Bank of Hawaii Private Banking, where a personal relationship manager and financial services team provide custom solutions. Learn more about Bank of Hawaii Private Banking at boh.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
For singer-songwriter Martha Redbone, music has always been a vehicle for self-discovery, and her new production, Bone Hill, the Concert, goes right to the heart of her identity as an American musical artist, a story of four generations of women in a Cherokee family living in the heart of Appalachia. The story comes from her own family. It's told in a presentation that's as much a theatrical performance as it is a concert. She and her troupe of actor-musicians are bringing Bone Hill to Hawaii, and she's with us this morning. Good morning, Martha.
Good morning. Thanks for having me here.
This is a story that was important for you to tell, wasn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
Why?
Most people, you know, when you think of Appalachia, when you think of Harlan County, most people think of coal. And they also think of people who are, you know, Scots Irish descent, and that's pretty much it.
Mm-hmm.
But my family have been in Harlan County since the beginning of time. We are descended from that land, which was the original Shawnee Cherokee territory,
mm-hmm.
And people don't really know that. That indigenous people have been there all along. They don't know that African Americans have been there and working as coal miners since the 1880s. They also don't know that that even during the Jim Crow eras and laws of segregation, that this little region was a big melting pot, kind of ruled by the coal companies who assigned homes for people, families to live. So you lived wherever they told you to live, and it was more an economic status than a racial status. So these are things I wanted to share.
And frequently when people of different color and races are put together in the same economic status, there's a lot of merging of traditions.
That's right. There's a lot of merging of everything.
Yeah, that's right.
Let's face it.
People being how
are. I'm a big merger.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, you yourself are a merger of a number of cultures, right?
That's
right. Reflected in your music.
That's right. And that's one of the things I really love about the concept of folk music.
Yeah.
You know, it's music from the people,
yeah,
who have come from wherever they've come from and have brought music from their homes. And then when you put them all together, this magic happens. Music happens. Magic happens whenever music is played anyways. But imagine a group of peoples from different ethnicities and backgrounds who jam together, the magic of that.
Well, it's got a purity to it. And, you know, whenever I hear the term folk music, I think, well, what other kind of music is there, right? Because, you know, obviously it should emanate from the people, their culture, their feelings. But you feel it so strongly when you hear it, that's right from the roots, don't you?
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
And that can be blues, that can be bluegrass, that can be any number of things, can't it?
That's right. I think it can be anything. I think the most important thing is that when this music comes together, it really tells the story. And hopefully will, if you haven't heard this type of music before, it draws you to some curiosity,
yeah,
to kind of look to look deeper.
Well, that's what Bone Hill is about, right? You're making music into a storytelling vehicle.
That's right. It's my hope to just share a little bit of the information about the land and the music and how we came to be. And I thought, you know, just as an Indigenous person and as an African-American person, I think it's for all people, but particularly from my own perspective, to share our stories, because people aren't really aware of this, in a way, an untold huge piece of American history,
yeah,
that it's not taught in schools. You have to find it. And I always feel that, there are 566 federally recognized tribes and a whole host of state recognized tribes waiting for recognition. But we have all of these different stories and backgrounds to share with people that people aren't aware of.
It's really important that they be kept up. And you were going to sing a little Acapulco sample.
That's right. This is a song that in the piece, Bone Hill the Concert, which I have to say was written by myself, my partner, my husband, Aaron Whitby, and also Roberta Uno, who is also a Native Hawaiian.
Mm-hmm.
And so we wrote the concert piece together, and this is a 90-minute piece. And an 8-piece ensemble that people will come to see, and it's all storytelling. And I kind of take on the characters of my family members, and in a way similar to kind of like a one woman show, but not quite,
yeah,
almost like that,
yeah,
with the band. But this particular song that Aaron and I wrote, it's called 40 Wheels, and the symbolism of what these 40 wheels mean in each of the generations that comes, how they continue to haunt us, and what it symbolizes each time. So that's what I'm singing. And this will be in the form of a mountain holler. So if you haven't had your coffee yet, wake up.
Mountain holler.
In our peaceful little world of Appalachia, way up high on the hills among the clouds, my people dwell. How sweet the silence in the still of our
sweet, the calling of our Lord. Black coal is running through our veins, bloody harlot, Kentucky. 40 wheels up high on a mountainside. 'Twas the Calvary took 1,000 lives. Haunt me. Haunt me. They haunt me. Way ah, hey, ah, way ah, hey, ah, way ah, hey, ah, way ah, hey.
I could hear many different strains in that little fragment, Martha. You know, the gospel, the bluegrass, whole what's considered the Appalachian sound, more that Scots-Irish strain. Beautiful, though.
Thank you.
Music is such an effective vehicle for telling a story if you tell it clearly, don't you think?
I think so. I think I think that's something that we all strive to
sure.
do, you know, and as a songwriter, you know, the greatest gift is clarity.
That's
you
right.
You know, it's for someone who knows nothing about you to be able to understand what you're trying to communicate.
Even to be able
to
tell what a song is about if you don't understand the words.
That's right.
That's
the emotion
really,
conveying the emotion through the melody.
That's when you're really getting somewhere.
Absolutely.
Martha, it's great to meet you. Great to talk to you.
Thanks for coming in. Thank you.
Martha Redbone and her cast of actor-musicians will perform Bone Hill, the concert, tomorrow at UH Manoa's Orvis Auditorium and Thursday at the Maui Arts and Cultural Center's Castle Theater. And you can find out more on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
Hi, good morning. I'm Karen Weichert from Wahine Media. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2. Find out more about the show at hawaiipublicradio.org/theconversation.
Could Hawaii soon be the only state in the nation with a Democrats-only state senate? If Republican Sam Slom loses to Democratic challenger and former Honolulu City Council member Stanley Chang, that's just what Hawaii will have. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
So could this be the last ride of Hawaii's Lone Ranger?
You know, I wouldn't give up on Sam just yet. He's been around a long time. He certainly has a lot of support in his district, and it's a huge district. It runs from Hawaii Kai to the edge of Waikiki, but certainly in Stanley Chang, he's got a very aggressive competitor. There are some certainly ideological differences as well. Sam is, in fact, the only Republican in the state Senate, and as we all know, Democrats control it. And should that happen, some are already saying what a terrible loss that would be, because whatever you think of Sam Slom, even his opponents agree that he's an effective legislative voice. He presents a more conservative point of view, no new taxes, less government interference. He leans libertarian. Those views would be gone from the Senate chamber and all those committee hearings that he attends should he fail to defeat Chang.
I mean, at this point, we're dealing with lots of conjecture, but looking at what that could potentially bring us after Election Day would be a very changed Senate. As you've been talking to other analysts, including, I know, Neil Milner and others, aside from just, you know, missing what he might bring to it, what changes could possibly happen with the Senate without having Sam Slom there?
and I have to give credit here. This is Denby Fawcett's story. She did a terrific job. Some have already pointed out, you know, that even within the Democratic Party, there's a lot of diversity, which is another way of saying they don't always get along. There's a lot of ideological differences. That was something that Senate President Ron Cochie shared with Denby. But the other reality is that they do a lot of their work behind closed doors. You'll see them, you know, when they're meeting in the chamber or in the Senate chamber there. And then they'll go into the caucus room, work things out and come out. One thing Sam Sloan has always done is said, well, you know, let's be more open. Let's be more transparent. He's the kind of guy that will actually give out his phone number and say, call me if you need some help. But with Chang, you've got someone that certainly is much younger. He's 40 years younger than Sam Sloan, Harvard educated, and he brings a new style. He's been going door to door, and this is a lot of doors that he's been knocking on. He actually has a smartphone app that he uses to keep track of all the homes that he's gone to. So he's sort of bringing in a fresher approach. The district has changed. It's not nearly as conservative as it used to be.
And yeah, very much so. In looking at, you know, newer families moving in, younger families moving in, a real resurgence of the area, not necessarily the same kind of district that Sam Sloan came into quite a while ago. Well, we don't have a long time to wait, only 2 weeks from today, and we'll see if that district, in fact, is going to change and what happens with the Senate. I'll talk to you in the morning, Chad.
I'll be here. Thanks,
I know you will. Thank you. Every day, Chad Blair joins us from Civil Beat with a reality check.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the 9th Annual Hallabaloo Festival, presenting Halloween cheer and music this Saturday at the Hawaii State Art Museum and surrounding streets, featuring Ioka, Charlie Hunter with Scott Amendola, and more. Hallabaloo.com.
It's exactly 2 weeks to Election Day. Most polls give Hillary Clinton a landslide lead in the Electoral College. Meanwhile, Donald Trump insists he's still on track to win. Increasingly, more Republicans are setting their sights down the ballot on the races to control the House, the Senate, and state houses. And the big question for both parties is what happens after November 8th, of President Clinton's ability to govern and the future of a deeply divided Republican Party. After 5 weeks away, news analyst Neil Conan has returned to his Macnut farm on the Big Island, and he joins us now as he does most Tuesdays. Welcome home.
Did anything happen while I was away?
Where would you like to start?
Well, I think it turns out one of the biggest moments in the presidential campaign happened just before I left. A race that, you know, looked close and tightening in early September started to open up after Donald Trump's dreadful performance in the first debate. Then the Billy Bush bus tape came out. Then almost a dozen women described behavior very much like what Trump bragged about on that tape. And then he really didn't do anything to change things in the second and third debates. Yeah, and it's interesting. Well, you know, we tend to focus on his mistakes because they have been legion. But Secretary Clinton looked very confident, competent, and cool throughout all of this, especially in the debates. And the fact that he did so badly was due in no small part to her preparation and her skill.
Now, poll aggregators put her lead at about 6 or 7 points. That's in the national polls. No presidential candidate has ever come back from a deficit that big this late in the race. You know, but this whole campaign has been so unpredictable, Neil. I mean, can anybody really think that it's all over?
Yeah, well, you know, two things would have to happen, and they would have to be both big. A dramatic event that would shift things in Trump's favor. I'm not exactly sure what that would be, but that's, I guess that's the nature of unpredictable events. And the polls could be, you know, way, way, way wrong.
Which is exactly what Donald Trump has been saying. I mean, not just wrong, but rigged by crooked media.
Well, let me get back to that crooked media later if we can. But there are a number of reasons to believe that most Republicans disagree with him about where the race is going. More and more super PACs are switching money and resources down ballot and saying explicitly that we need to elect, Kelly Ayotte, for example, as a break on Hillary Clinton. Democrats from Clinton on down are also focusing more and more on the House and Senate. President Obama took time to record ads for 150 legislative candidates. Now, the Clinton camp is still focused on the White House, make no mistake about that, but she wants to bring in as many Democrats as she can to help her govern, and she wants to win big to build something like might look like a mandate, and she would like to do everything she can to crush Donald Trump and Trumpism.
Okay, let's talk about that for a second. How do you define Trumpism?
Well, I would define its base as, you know, the sort of anti-government anger and the sense of grievance that he has exploited. Immigrants are stealing our jobs. Blacks are living off welfare. Both parties are corrupt cronies of Wall Street and the big corporations. You know, it's that sort of racist, sexist, authoritarian, xenophobic fringe of American society that's come to find a home on websites like Breitbart, you know, a sort of white nationalist ideology that's sometimes called the alt-right.
You bring up Breitbart. Now, Steve Bannon, the president of Breitbart, came on as the chief executive of the Trump campaign in the most recent shakeup. What do you make of this?
Well, yeah, he came along with Kellyanne Conway as the campaign manager. Now, she got a lot of the credit for the discipline and message that helped Trump make this a closer race back in August and early September. But as things have spiraled out of control since the first debate, you see a lot more of Bannon's influence. So where, you know, they don't even seem to be trying to broaden Trump's appeal, but rather to harden his support with his base, with an emphasis on, you know, the rigged election, phony polls, and crooked media.
Okay, so which is something we wanted to talk about a little earlier. Let's get to it now.
Well, there's every reason to believe that Donald Trump is looking past the election as well. Now, he might win it. Long shots do come around to win sometimes. But on the assumption he doesn't, he has set himself up to create an alt-right media empire. He obviously started in a very successful TV show, The Apprentice, as we know. He has Steve Bannon of Breitbart, Roger Ailes, the ousted chief executive of Fox. His son-in-law, Jared Kushner, already owns a newspaper. With Ailes' departure from Fox, it looks as if that network might move a tick or two to the left, you know, less Sean Hannity, more Chris Wallace, which would leave a space on the far right for an outfit that would combine digital and TV, a news outlet with talk shows, maybe Sean Hannity, reality and lifestyle programs. Even if he's wiped out, Donald Trump can expect to get 50 million votes. Say half of those are Republicans holding their nose to vote against Hillary Clinton and for the Supreme Court. That other half is more than enough audience to sustain a media group that would make that, you know, white nationalist alt-right movement far more visible and far more important.
You're bringing this right back to the whole point of, you know, was this all about building brand Trump? This also sounds especially scary for establishment Republicans like, you know, Paul Ryan, Speaker of the House. He's been in open warfare, as you know, with Donald Trump in these past few weeks, particularly. Not
good. Yeah,
it was
interesting. Ryan disinvited Trump from what would have been their one and only joint campaign appearance in Wisconsin. That was right after the Billy Bush tape. He said he could no longer defend Donald Trump, but he did not withdraw his endorsement, which speaks to the power of Trump's supporters, both those members of Congress who were solidly behind him and the Republican base that gave him the nomination. Now, there are not all that many House Republicans in competitive races there, but they're in the same, the ones that are in the same spot as so many Republican Senate candidates. If they repudiate Trump, well, you know, they might win over the independents. They're going to need to win, but they also risk alienating those base Trump supporters who would see this as betrayal.
Okay, so how do you see that playing out?
Well, Senate races are easier to follow, and there are much better polls in the Senate than for House candidates. Look at Arizona. John McCain disendorsed Trump after the Billy Bush tape. He has a credible opponent. Arizona is actually in play for the Democrats this year. Michelle Obama is going to be there to campaign. You know, I think Hillary might have a shot in Arizona. McCain looks safe enough. He's actually going out of state to campaign in places like New Hampshire, where his friend Kelly Ayotte is in deep trouble against former Governor Mackey Hassan. Ayotte disavowed Trump late as well in Pennsylvania. Republican incumbent Pat Toomey has tried to distance himself from Trump without actually unendorsing him. He has an inexperienced Democrat, Katie McGinty, running against him. She's trying to hang Trump around his neck. He's painting her as a rubber stamp for Hillary Clinton. Now, that one's close, but if Clinton carries Pennsylvania 6-8, you know, it's hard to see how Toomey survives.
Okay, so what happens then to the Republican Party? You've got an angry Trump faction that could refuse maybe to accept the results. You've got an establishment group that's failed in the primaries, which could obviously lose some control in the Senate and lose a lot of seats in the House as well.
Well, if it plays out that way, imagine the unhappy future that faces Paul Ryan. Now, the Speaker is going to have a very loud and angry group of 40 to 50 in what's now called the Freedom Caucus. This is mainly the old Tea Party types and now, you know, Trumpian populists. These are the people who ousted John Boehner as insufficiently conservative, and they are not going to be happy with Ryan either. If he actually wants to pass any legislation that a Democratic president would sign, he needs their votes, or he needs to cooperate with the Democrats, and cooperation with Democrats might be political suicide for a Republican speaker. In the Senate, you know, John McCain let out a big hint. Last week he said Republicans would block any Supreme Court nominee, that a President Clinton might nominate. Now, he walked that back a little bit, but right now scorched earth seems a lot more likely in Washington than any kind of honeymoon.
We've got to go in just a minute, but I wanted to ask you about the Democrats, because they've got their divisions, too. I mean, look, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, but they're out campaigning for Hillary Clinton right now, and many are still upset by the WikiLeaks, especially those on the left. No smoking guns likely to affect the general election, but those stolen emails from the Clinton campaign chair, from John Podesta, reveals that there were those paid speeches where Clinton delivered, you know, to Wall Street companies like Goldman Sachs, and some of the things that she said in them, that there's a fair amount of derogatory, some would say even rude remarks about Sanders in particular.
Well, it was interesting. Bernie Sanders said if you looked at the private emails of his campaign, a lot of derogatory and rude remarks about Hillary Clinton. That's kind of the way politics works. I'm sure that Bernie would have raised questions about Clinton's open borders remark if he'd had that statement back in the primary. But, you know, this big, vast dump of stolen emails has revealed the Clinton campaign and the candidate as cautious, pragmatic, centrist, more focused on winning than on vision, maybe. But that's absolutely nothing we did not know about Hillary Clinton. The bigger question, yes, the left wing of the party looks ascendant right now, and certainly Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren will take a skeptical look at a Clinton administration, very closely at cabinet appointments, especially Supreme Court nominees. But the divisions of the Democratic Party are nothing compared to the Republicans.
All right. Meanwhile, we got another hell freezing over campaign in the World Series. Don't have much time to talk to you about that, but hey, gotta love those Cubs.
I gotta go for Cleveland.
Okay. We'll have some fun later. Thanks, Neil. Talk to you next week.
You bet, Beth. And thanks for Ken Rudin for filling in while I was away.
You bet. We enjoyed that, too, and glad you're home safely. News analyst Neil Conan joins us most Tuesdays from the farm, and his Pacific News Minutes are back, too, right here on Hawaii Public Radio.
Support for today's programming comes from the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra, featuring violinist Ray Chen in Brooks Violin Concerto No. 1 and Holst's The Planets, with Maestro Sarah Ioannidis at the Blaisdell, 4 p.m. this Sunday. More at hisymphony.org.
Helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of.
It's just something that you want to do.
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. In ancient Hawaii, taro was much more than a food staple. It was the center of the economy, and it influenced the political and spiritual life of the people. Cultivation of taro declined during the 20th century to the point where the art of growing it almost vanished. Fortunately, groups like Aina Mamona sprang up to rescue taro farming. Hui Aloha Aina Mamona is an organization that is working to promote taro and pa'i'ai, not just for its food benefits, but as a cultural and environmental force engaged in restoring Aina Mamona, or abundant land, in Hawaii. As active stewards of the land, they conduct educational activities to teach the many benefits of the plant and revive our relationship to the Aina. Grants have been provided to help fund this community education and restoration project. In doing so, funders are helping Aina Mamona teach the nutritional and ecological values of taro, and as a result, our community will reconnect with the earth. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you.
And now we're going to get back to today's backyard quiz. Now, our subject this morning was Norman Keith Collins, probably not the name that you know him by. He was born in Reno, Nevada, 1911. He is forever identified with the art of tattooing, a world where he's remembered as a pioneer and innovator. He set up shop in Honolulu's Chinatown in the 1930s and became popular with sailors traveling through the busy port. He developed new pigments, created needle formations that embedded those pigments with less trauma to the skin, and was one of the first to employ single-use needles as autoclave for sterilization. His now legendary designs included Hawaii themes, dice, bottles of booze, birds of prey, snakes. Many are still popular to this day. In his day, though, tattoo parlors were only found in Chinatown, and he'd likely be amazed at the popularity of his ideas today. He died in 1973 and is buried in the National Memorial Cemetery of the Pacific, where people occasionally stop by to remember the legacy of Sailor Jerry.
And Beth Ann, Michael Delaney of Manoa did remember that legacy, was the first to call with the correct answer, and he's got an HPR T-shirt on its way to him. And at 8:50, that's today's quiz. If you've got a quiz for us, you can always send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from the College of Business at Hawaii Pacific University, whose MBA Flex Plus program offers a blend of classroom and online classes to fit the lives of working professionals. hpu.edu/business.
The Maui Farm in Makaua'au is built on the premise that we can be enriched and even healed by working on the land, learning to grow the foods that sustain us, learning to work cooperatively, and learning to pass along our knowledge to those who come along after us. Maria Leon is the Maui Farm's farm-based program coordinator, and she's with us by phone from there. Good morning, Maria.
Good morning, Chris. Thanks for having me.
This is a lot more than a farm, isn't it?
It definitely is. We offer transitional housing for mothers and their children who are homeless because they've escaped domestic violence.
Mm-hmm.
So the farm is meant to help them reintegrate back into the community, help them build the skills to be now a single parent. And it's also meant to be therapeutic, I find particularly for the children.
I imagine, but why? How is working on the land therapeutic? What's the effect it has?
I think it's about getting back to your roots, literally, like physically and also culturally. Working in the dirt has a lot of good feeling. It's therapeutic. It's meditative for some of the moms. It's a chance for them to clear their heads. For the children, we also have animals, and that's where most of our families and children choose to work. We have pigs, goats, chickens, and bunnies, and they find that nurturing and taking care for another animal can be very rewarding and healing in the process.
Kids have an automatic attachment to animals, don't they?
Absolutely, especially the bunnies. I think because they get to actually hold them, they're light and they're nice and fluffy for them to pet.
Sure, sure. Well, you must see evidence all the time of the kind of effect that this contact has on young families.
Yes, it does. And one of our goals is also to even just inspire them to take what they learned after they move on from the Maui Farm into their own homes, whether it's having a pet bunny or growing a container garden on their apartment porch. So we're really trying to get them inspired to take the skills they learned on the farm with them and to teach others about it as well.
And that's a big part of the cycle, isn't it, Maria? The whole thing of passing along what you have learned.
Absolutely.
When you say that you can make a container garden, I think a lot of people hold back from growing their own food by the fact that, well, they say, well, I don't have a patch of land. But it's not, these days, it's not that necessary, is it?
Not at all. And we offer field trips, farm tours, to kind of get people, one, inspired, but also show them that it's not that hard. You can grow certain crops in small pots, Or even if you hooied up with your neighbors and one of you grew bananas and the other grew papayas, you could trade. You don't have to have a whole farm or a big garden. You can just do one simple ag act, and it could go a long way.
What's a good crop to, let's say if you wanted to, maybe you had a little bit of a space on your lanai or something for a container. What's a good crop to get for the complete novice to get started with?
Yeah. So the herbs always work great. I'm sure that's what a lot of people already grow. But things like lettuce, things that are easy, that don't take a lot of attention or that don't get pests. So lettuce is a good one. People do tomatoes because they produce a lot of fruit off of one plant. So there's a variety of things out there.
On your farm, you mentioned pests, and how do you deal with them?
Yeah, so we're an organic farm. We're not certified organic, but we use sustainable ag practices. We actually use Dr. Bronner's. It's an organic soap and water. So we put one tablespoon of soap into a gallon of water, and we spray our crops with it. It's non-toxic, but it is toxic to the bugs. It kind of drowns them out.
Well, that's a pretty good tip for just about anybody with
your
garden.
Yeah, really cheap and easy to do. So,
why don't more people do that, Maria?
I don't know, to be honest. So that's what we're trying to teach is, there are other ways of pest control, even planting, like we have lemongrass bordering our crop field, and the pests tend to not like anything that has a scent to it. So there's lots of things you can do. I think you just got to get out there and get educated or do some research. There's a ton of things online as well for organic gardening.
So it sounds like it's pretty learnable for most of us.
Absolutely. It's really easy. I think, like you said before, some people can be intimidated by starting their own garden, but it's the same things you learn in kindergarten. It's soil, sun, water. It's back to the basics, really.
Sounds like a good way to go. Thanks a lot for talking with us, Maria.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Maria Leon is the Maui Farm's farm-based program coordinator. Maui Farm is in Makawao, Maui, on an 8.3-acre property leased from the county. It offers free tours the last Saturday of every month, and you can learn more about it on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Maui Arts and Cultural Center, presenting Haunted Hawaiian Nights. Storyteller Lopaka Kapanui shares ghostly tales and legends of Hawaii. 7:30 p.m. this Friday. MauiArts.org.
Beth Ann, the whole idea of working on a farm as a way of healing a family makes a lot of sense.
Well, it's one of the reasons why we give kids things to grow when they're very small, when they're in, kindergarten, first grade, preschool even, because there's something magical that happens when you work with dirt and you work with plants. And if you magnify that with families who are in crisis, sometimes that can help in some ways to move through that crisis.
And seeing something that you yourself grew and brought to fruition, that can be pretty rewarding.
As anyone who has even a small patio kitchen garden knows.
That's right.
It's true. Now, that's going to do it for us for this Tuesday morning. We'll be back with you tomorrow. We're going to launch our new series, The Last Job in Hawaii, looking at what jobs can we expect to be automated in Hawaii over the next 15 years or so. We'll also talk with UH Law Professor Maxine Burkett about Charter Amendment 7.
And we'll have a live in-studio preview of this weekend's Hullabaloo.
We'd like to hear from you, as we always tell you, and we're truthful in that one. You can reach us anytime you want at 808-792-8217, or if you like, email, do that at Hawaii Public Radio, at talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
If you missed any of the show or want a past show, you can always find them archived on the Conversation page. Just look under Talk Shows for the Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you in the morning back here with more of The Conversation.